She was an orphan girl who made it to the top, winning history's first recorded beauty contest. On Storyline, we meet a woman who was prepared to risk everything and go where no woman had ever dared, for those she loved. Welcome to Storyline. I'm Chantel Klingbeil. Thank you for joining me. We're coming to you live. This means that if you want to ask a question or contribute to the program, you're very welcome to do so throughout our show. It's actually simple, and you can even pick the way you want to do it. You could call toll-free at 888-9-STORYLINE. Or use 707-200-1070 to call or to text. And for that more instant interaction, you can find Storyline on Facebook. Storyline is all about stories, not bedtime stories or children's stories, but real, true-to-life stories of Bible characters that faced issues, challenges, and faith questions. People who lived in times of change, times of crisis. In Storyline, we focus on these Bible characters. We look over their shoulders as they faced economic challenges, struggled with family problems, fell in love, or faced illness and had their lives torn apart by war. As we step into their world, to study life from their perspective, we look at their challenges, heartbreaks, victories, to find clues for our lives. Studying these Bible characters gives us new perspectives that we can apply. And the best part of it all is that in these storylines, we find a God who loves us intensely and immensely. I think every young girl dreams of being a princess. And of course, she wants that grand royal wedding in which she marries her prince. Girls or boys, men or women, we would all love to have a happily ever after in our lives. Unfortunately, real life looks very different. We are living in a battle zone, and even for an orphan girl who catches the king's eye, life is not a fairy tale. If you have your Bible nearby, you can find the story in a book named after the main character, Esther. Let's rewind about 2,500 years. The ancient world was not orphan friendly, especially for a girl. Fortunately for Esther, her cousin Mordecai took her in after the death of her parents. Mordecai's great-grandfather had come from Babylon many, many years before, and Mordecai had been born and raised in a foreign country. He had a respectable job at the palace, but yet Mordecai never forgot who he was, who he worshipped, and where he came from. These essential values he passed on to Esther. And then the king had domestic trouble, which spilt over into the lives of Mordecai and Esther. The king disposed of his queen and sent officers to find a new queen. The young ladies did not have any choice in the matter. The officers made the selection. They didn't even sign a consent form. And they could look forward to a year of beauty treatments and then one appointment with the king, one opportunity to impress him. He would only be choosing one new queen. For those who didn't make the grade, they could look forward to spending the rest of their lives quarantined in the concubine house. But Esther was more than a pretty face. She was different. Knowing who she was, who she worshipped, made her different, beautifully different. The king saw the difference. He made Esther queen. For Esther, knowing who she was and who she worshipped seemed to be the key to her success. For Mordecai, the opposite seemed true. You see, the king's new prime minister, Haman, he was trying to cement his authority by demanding godlike respect from everyone. Mordecai, knowing who he was and who he worshipped, knew that this godlike respect did not belong to Haman. Haman was angry enough to want revenge. He had a specially built, custom-designed gallows erected just for Mordecai. But his revenge went so far that he decided to exterminate the entire Jewish population while he was about it. Haman set the Jewish people up as enemies of the state and got the king to sign a decree that on a certain day, all of the Jewish people could be killed and their property seized. Mordecai, of course, was horrified when he saw this law. He dressed in sackcloth and went down the street mourning as if he were at his own funeral already. He went and stood outside the entrance to the palace. Esther got word of Mordecai outside and sent a trusted servant to find out what was going on. Mordecai had a copy of the king's law ready for him. He gave it to the servant along with very specific instructions that he was to give to Esther. He told the servant to pass on to Esther that she would need to go before the king to plead for the lives of her people. Up until now, Esther, acting on Mordecai's instructions, hadn't told anyone that she was Jewish. She sent a message back to Mordecai explaining the danger of the situation for her personally. "There is a rule here," she said. "Everyone knows it. It applies to both men and women, that no one is authorized to go before the king uninvited. If you would dare, the result would be death. Unless the king holds out his golden scepter, then you get spared. But I don't have much hope. You see, it's been over a month since the king has sent for me." Mordecai sends a message back. It's not tactful, it's not politically correct, but it does draw the line in the sand, at least for Esther. "Esther, don't think that just because you're in the palace, you can escape the fate of all of us. If you choose to play it safe, if you choose to be silent at this moment, I believe God will send help from some other source. As for you, I don't know, but who knows? Esther, who knows? Perhaps God has permitted you to become queen for precisely this moment." For Esther, this was decision time. Would she just slip back into her comfortable world and try to pretend that she was something she was not? Or would she be willing to risk everything to stand up for who she was and, most importantly, who she worshipped? Esther made her decision. She sends a message back to Mordecai. Gather all the Jews together and fast and pray for me for 3 days. I and my maids will also pray for 3 days, and then I will go to the king, unannounced. If I die, I die. This decision is the turning point for Esther, for Mordecai, for the whole Jewish population. It reads even better than a happily ever after. Esther does go before the king. He does stretch out his scepter. Esther stands up for who she is and who she worships, and God uses her to save an entire nation. Esther's world is very different from ours. Not very many of us have high-powered positions that can affect the course of nations, or not many of us could afford to take a year off on beauty treatments. To help us weave into this story of Esther, we have with us today a special guest who is a fiber artist and a docent at a historical house. Welcome to Storyline, Heidi.
Thank you.
Great to have you again.
Thank you.
Well, if you are wondering what a docent does or why Heidi is so very fashionably attired, we'll be finding out right after the break. So stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
As I was reading through The Great Hope, this passage caught my eye. Thus the death of Christ was the climax of the proof that their belief had been correct. The reason this passage brings me hope is because I knew when I had first started out on my Christian walk, God had to save me. But it took a lot. It took His sacrifice and His death to show me that He was still alive today in my life. And because of His life, I'm here today talking to you about The Great Hope. And the reason it gives me so much hope, and that hope is placed solely in Jesus Christ. He is my everything, my Redeemer. He is my one great hope.
Heidi Ashton is a fiber artist and a docent at a historical house. Well, welcome to Storyline again.
Thank you.
Last time you were on Storyline, we had you tell us about weaving. And I think we were talking about the story of Hannah.
Yes.
So that was a great story.
Lots of fun, lots of fiber.
Lots of fiber. And we got you back. But this time you are dressed very fashionably. But for what era?
For about the year 1853.
Okay, now I've introduced you as a docent. What is a docent?
A docent is an educational volunteer who takes the time to explain history mm-hmm. to others at the historic houses, much as an art docent would in an art museum.
So you give us an opportunity to talk to someone from this time period.
Or someone who's experienced the crafts of the time period.
It's the closest we're going to get.
For now.
Now, it would have been lovely if we could have spoken to Esther. But this is good, too. I want to have a good look, and I want our viewers to be able to see how beautiful you look over here. Tell us a little bit about your outfit. What's it made of?
My dress is made of linen.
Mm-hmm. Can I feel it?
Sure.
Okay.
It's not as hot as it uh-huh. looks.
It looks very warm.
But it's not.
Okay.
In 1853, if you were a middle-class person, mm-hmm. you might have two or three garments. So there's a chance you would have a summer dress and a winter dress. But if you were not that wealthy, you wouldn't. Mm-hmm. You would have one that would have sleeves that would function for both summer and winter.
Imagine that, one dress for summer and winter.
I know.
Choices aren't very big.
And the dresses are expensive.
Okay.
Because the cotton's being milled in France and sent back to America. or in other parts of Europe or in the north, and then it's being sent back to wherever you live. And then you have to buy it and cut it and sew it, and it's a whole process.
Well, tell us a little bit. You actually sewed this dress yourself?
Yes.
Following a historic pattern?
I followed a historic pattern, but they wanted it for the year of 1853. So I bought an 1860s pattern, 1860, 1865 pattern. I looked at the dress they wanted me to make. I took the similarities and incorporated them into a pattern and changed it to make an 1853 dress.
So I see you have, what should I say, off the shoulders or dropped shoulders?
A drop sleeve.
That seems to be very fashionable.
A mutton sleeve.
Do you have a corset?
I have boning in the bodice of the mm-hmm. dress. They would have worn a corset with it. Corsets were not unusual for some time. Even during the 1700s, they wore corsets, but they were a means of supporting themselves.
Shape your figure yet.
Right. Kind of like a back brace. And
okay.
People say they were really quite comfortable to wear.
I find that hard to believe.
It's not until the 1860s that we start pulling that waist
in. Yes. And there we have this teeny weeny little waist.
Yes, one that a man's hands can span.
So that's an ideal of beauty.
It's an ideal of beauty.
Well, we can't talk about Esther without talking about beauty. How does fashion, I mean, you are beautifully attired for that time period, but you look a little old-fashioned for now. How does beauty and fashion reflect each other?
Beauty and fashion are very important, and they're very important in Esther because the first statement she makes when she enters that grand hall of the king is a statement of beauty. When she meets the king for the first time, it's a statement of beauty. So he judges her off of beauty first. Mm-hmm. People tend to do this. They judge off of looks first. They look at the person. Are they symmetrical? How are they shaped? Are they tall? Are they proportional?
And that can vary from time to time and from age to age.
Certainly.
Okay.
And beauty in different cultures is different.
Mm-hmm.
The waists in
yes.
1860 were very small and very tight. And an evening dress might have no sleeves mm-hmm. or be cut very low across the chest. That was perhaps not the style just a few years before.
So it changed completely. Well, I want to come over here. You've got some more attire of your dress. What are these outfits? Well, this is gloves, right?
Gloves.
Okay.
I would take gloves with me.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
A purse, a shawl, and of course a hat. But I didn't bring my hat tonight.
Well, you're fairly navy. I don't suppose people are wearing very bright, loud colors back then. On the whole.
Serviceable colors.
Serviceable colors.
Black.
Navy. So good, serviceable color.
Navy, brown. And mm-hmm. if you're going to do a party dress, then you do your non-serviceable colors.
Well,
your
I guess...
Your pinks, your purples, your frills.
Well, this was party attire by Esther. It's strange
yes.
that in the first chapter of Esther, we have a lot of fabrics and colors mentioned.
Lots.
Just really briefly, you brought us a couple of examples of, I guess this is fabric types that are mentioned in Esther?
These are fabric types. Some of them are fabric types that would have been found in mm-hmm. Esther. So, for example, this is a fabric woven with gold.
Wow. And they used gold. I guess this is...
This is a synthetic gold, but mm-hmm. they would have used real gold and silver and woven it into fabrics. Very elaborate. Mm-hmm. Common people. Wool.
Wool. Would it have been these kind
Very
of colors?
Serviceable. Yes, perhaps.
Browns.
Very dull, muted, serviceable colors.
That wouldn't
Again.
Show the dirt.
That's right.
That's wise.
Or the wear. Easy to mend. This is a silk.
And now blue seems to be a big color back for Esther.
It is. And it's mm-hmm. mentioned several or at least once in the first chapter. It is a silk.
Mm-hmm. Where were they getting silk? I think China.
The Silk Road, the trade with China. The Persian Empire was large. It was vast.
Mm-hmm.
Another fabric that's mentioned in Esther, but I don't have here tonight, is cotton.
Okay.
Cotton comes from Egypt. It's grown in the river, the Nile.
So Delta. We're stretching all the way from India all the way to the Nile. This is a vast, vast empire back then.
And into Greece.
And all the way into Greece.
Yes.
And all of this we're getting out of our colors, or are demonstrated by our colors and fabrics
yes.
that people are using back there.
Mm-hmm. So this is linen.
Mm-hmm.
And
who would wear linen? You're wearing linen.
Common, upper class people.
Mm-hmm. Why would linen be a choice?
It's cool.
It's cool.
But they have cold nights in Persia, and so wool would have been an appropriate choice too. But linen is cool. It is also the fabric of sackcloth.
So when we hear about Mordecai dressing himself in sackcloth, I always thought brown or a dark color, but this is more or less...
This is a bleached linen, so it could be a brown or a gray.
Sort of a beigey gray that he would be wearing. Well,
and then the ashes on his head, and you get this very muted picture of a person in mourning.
So the bright colors go when you're in mourning, and those are these muted colors that reflect how you feel
yes.
in your colors and in your wear.
Yes.
Well, thank you for adding some color to our story and texture, color and texture to our story of Esther.
Thank you.
This is a great story. Whatever was considered beautiful back then, Esther had it. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us anything about her figure, clothing size, or the color of her hair or eyes. These are beauty markers that change as quickly as Heidi's fashion here. But the Bible does tell us about some enduring traits that made her beautiful, even thousands of years later. After the break, we're back with more special guests as we explore this beautiful story. Esther's story. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
There is a garden in every childhood, an enchanted place where colors are brighter, the air softer, and the morning more fragrant than ever.
Of all life seasons, childhood is the most beautiful.
Children are the living messages we send to a time we will not see.
Blessed indeed is the man who hears many gentle voices call him Father.
A child can ask a thousand questions that the wisest man cannot answer.
When I approach a child, I have two thoughts: affection for what he is today and respect for what he can become.
There are no seven wonders of the world in the eyes of a child. There are 7 million.
Children are one-third of our population and all of our future.
He called a little child to him and placed the child among them. And he said, "Truly, I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever takes the lowly position of this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me."
The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge. They have no speech, they use no words, no sound is heard from them, yet their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world.
The Persian Empire was well known for its excellent communication system. The 127 provinces stretching from India to Egypt were connected by a system of mounted couriers. Which, of course, reminds me of Storyline. We have all sorts of tools to help us connect and communicate, too. You can call us, text us, find Storyline on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, download the app, or subscribe to the HD podcast. We really do enjoy hearing about how Storyline has impacted your life. Our story today, Esther, was requested by viewers. And a big thank you to all of you who have contacted Storyline with your comments and questions. It's always a pleasure interacting with you. Last week, if you can think back a whole week, we had a male expert panel as we explored Ezekiel's vision. This week, just to balance things out, we have a beautiful female team. We are really happy to have Heidi Ashton, who did our hands-on section. I'm glad that she's staying on with us. And you'll notice she's still in costume. Thank you, Heidi. You are definitely the most elegantly dressed, if I may say so. We also have Dr. Lisa Beardsley-Hardy. She is the director of the Department of Education at the General Conference of Seventh-day Adventists. Thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
With the busy schedule you have, we appreciate you taking the time. And we also have Melinda Paul. Now, Melinda is a pre-med student who's in between studies. She's doing research at the moment, and she was telling me all sorts of exciting things. Like, she's also working at a fire station?
Department, yeah.
Fire department. And you have a passion for Bible stories. And it's just great to have you with us. We also have with us Franita Buddy. Now, she's normally our behind-the-scenes lady. She produces various programs for Hope Channel. But she's also great fun, and she's profound on this side of the camera. So we are really glad that we were able to get Franita from that side to this side this evening. Well, are you ladies ready? Shall we tackle Esther?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, there are only two books in the Bible that carry women's names. Esther and?
Ruth.
Yeah. Both have really strong female characters as the central figures over here. But there are some obvious differences and similarities between these stories. What are some of the most striking for you?
Well, the first thing you mentioned is strength in the women. And what I love about the similarities between the two of them is actually the strength that I see in their submission. Both of them are so willing to take on advice and come, you know, and to choose what they're doing based on the authority figures that have been put in their life. Ruth, of course, going with Naomi and sort of allowing her to lead her through her choices in life, and of course with Esther, Mordecai.
So this is a real contradiction, strength in submission.
Yeah. And another part of that is the seeming hopelessness of each of their situations. Mm. Widows who have
What
no
about
children,
Esther? She doesn't sound very hopeless
who's
to
me. Orphan.
Ah, yeah.
And in taking the role of a queen, following a queen that was deposed. So there wasn't a lot of latitude for her to make any missteps in this. And then, of course, the edict of genocide against her people. So insurmountable obstacles. It looks like things were not going to go well. And women throughout time have felt helpless. So it's very much a story for us today as well.
You mean it's a contemporary story?
But especially as similarities, their age. I would think that they were both under 20 facing being orphaned, Esther being an orphan, and then also Ruth being a widow at such an early age, and then, of course, those positions, society didn't think much of them, but yet they did some miraculous things at a very young age.
So, young woman?
Absolutely. I still count myself in the young woman group, so yay for young women.
Do I qualify? No, okay, don't answer. That's my question. Okay. Let's put the story a little bit in context. You touched on it a little bit already, Lisa. We think of Esther, we think fairy tale. We think, well, you know, that fairy tale dress, becomes a queen. But this isn't exactly a true life fairy tale, is it? What's Esther up against?
Not at all. I mean, she is chosen. Excuse me. She's following a deposed queen out of some very tough circumstances, and she's expected to fill these shoes. And then also, she was chosen out of hundreds of women throughout the country. So,
but shouldn't that be a plus?
It is, but it's a lot of pressure, mm-hmm. especially in the public eye. There's a scrutiny. There's complaints. People, and especially in a political atmosphere, people may be threatening your life, and she's sort of forced into this. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't easy, I'm sure.
Okay, so this is a very strange situation over here. Well, we are going to be right back to continue this conversation, so don't go anywhere. We will be right back.
When I was listening to the Great Hope, a phrase came across that I found very interesting. While the investigative judgment is going forward in heaven, while the sins of penitent believers are being removed from the sanctuary, there is to be a special work of purification, of putting away of sin among God's people upon earth. You see, Jesus is doing his thing up in heaven, but we also need to do our thing here on earth. And what is that? Giving it our all to God, giving everything to Him, bowing down at the foot of the cross. And you know what the cross means? The cross means Christ's redemption, obliterating Satan's schemes. Satan's schemes have no power over us. God is first and only.
The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of His hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge. They have no speech, they use no words, no sound is heard from them. Yet their voice goes out into all the earth. Their words to the ends of the world.
Just in case you are joining us, this fantastic team here, and we are discussing the story of Esther. Now, I don't want to leave this question because it's a great question. We're looking at the darkest side of the fairy tale. How glamorous it was to be married to the most powerful man in the world. And you were saying...
In many ways, this king illustrates the darker side of leadership. Mm-hmm. He illustrates a man who had become so powerful that he became a victim of his own power. He was surrounded by yes men who told him what he wanted to hear. He indulged too much in alcohol, and he made some terrible decisions, things that he regretted himself.
He always seemed to be drinking when it came to
the big decisions. He was drinking, and he made a very unwise decision with his wife, who I think he really loved, because after she was deposed, he started to regret it.
We're talking about Queen Vashti.
Queen Vashti. And then the men that had advised him were in danger of losing their own heads, and they thought, we've got to think of a plan. We've got to keep him entertained, and we've got to find some other way of diverting his attention. But even then, he didn't learn, because we find him again with a glass in his hand, toasting to another bad decision. He'd handed over his signet ring.
And, to Haman this time, of
Haman,
all people.
His prime minister, and he authorized, he said, do what you want with these people.
And he just
genocide of a people through these 127 provinces. He seemed incapable of using power in wise ways, mm-hmm. and those around him knew that. So in many ways, he was not a good king, and a dangerous king, not somebody to be trifled with.
And we have in this story, apart from the danger of the king, of having this man for your husband, just the fact that she mentions that she hasn't seen him for 30 days, it's not exactly a close relationship that you're looking at over here. I almost get the impression of a gilded cage, kind of a damp on our fairy tale, isn't it?
Yeah, not the Prince Charming that we would have thought at all, no.
And yet, here she is. She begins the story very passively. It's not as we might go hunting our Prince Charming. She's selected. She's very passive in the story. I mean, that's what a girl would be, really passive. She doesn't ask for anything special when she makes her appearance before the king. She follows Mordecai's orders to keep quiet about her background. And then comes the turning point. And she starts giving orders. Mordecai, get the Jews together, fast. I'm going to fast, going to pray, and then I'm going to do. How does that fit for today? I mean, can we learn anything about roles, about keeping quiet, about stepping out of them?
Well, I'm thinking of the verse, Esther 4:14, where Mordecai, her cousin, talks to her and says that you've come to a certain position for a certain time, which mm-hmm. is one of my favorite verses. And if you remain quiet, the Lord will bring up someone else to do the job that he has given you to do. So it may seem scary, but the Lord empowers those that he calls. And so obviously she was called to do something, and so the Lord empowered her to do this. So making orders and calling orders, well, she was queen.
She was queen. Okay, but my question, and I love that verse. Thank you, Franita. I think it's a favorite. Huh?
Yes.
For such a time as this,
yes.
you were called.
Yes.
But the question, I'd like to pull it a little further. How do I know when it's time to be quiet, to be submissive, to do what's expected of me by society, by others, and when is it time for me to step out of my comfort zone? Because this isn't just someone who wants to lead a demonstration or something. I mean, she is in a life-threatening position. She's stepping way out of her comfort zone. When do I know?
Unlike her husband, she made her decisions very carefully. She didn't rashly run into this. Mm-hmm. And Mordecai talked with her. He persuaded her. He showed her the evidence. Mm-hmm. He showed her a copy of the edict. He even told her the exact amount of money that he was willing to pay. And it was a significant sum of money. It was about 20 million U.S. dollars today. It was a significant sum of money that he was willing to put in. So he told the exact amount of money, and then he made an appeal to her, and then she reflected on it. Mm-hmm. And she asked him to also join her in that reflection. So she was a careful decision maker, not a rash decision maker like her husband.
Okay, so number one, it would be don't step out just for the sake of stepping out necessarily. Think about where you're going, who you're influencing, and what you can do with your influence. She seemed to use her influence very sparingly.
And she weighed the evidence. Mm-hmm. When Haman said, there's a people in your country and they don't keep the laws, he didn't weigh any evidence at all. He just handed over his ring.
Yeah.
Do with him as you please.
Right. So we have a real contrasting figure over here with a husband. How do you feel, Heidi, about playing safe and about moving from passive to active? You're wearing the costume of an era where I think of ladies as being more passive.
And yet there were strong women in that era too who took the time to step out, and we have some of the rights and civil rights today because they took the time to step out, both in 1853 and later.
Mm-hmm. So we had real big steps in different social issues, positive changes that were initiated by women stepping out of the comfort zone, historically.
We have the right to vote in America because a woman stepped out of her social comfort zone.
Okay, well, there we have an Esther that you wouldn't think of,
yeah.
kind of. In linen.
and I love her resoluteness. When she makes up her decision, that she says, I'm going, and if I perish, I perish. Mm-hmm. She's going.
And I love what comes right before that, too. You know, we say that there's a shift from passive to mm-hmm. a more active role, but what happens in that first active sort of way of going about what she's doing is that she makes a command to take a moment and to step aside and to spend that time fasting and praying. And mm-hmm. and to me, that shift is so beautiful because it isn't really a shift. It's what she's been doing all along. It's this idea of, like I said before, this submission to being able to think about the situation and, like we've said, and carefully sort of weigh what she's doing with what God wants her to do.
Now, I'd like to take that thought a little bit further Melinda, you just touched on fasting and stepping aside to fast. Now, fasting seems to be coming back into fashion nowadays. I noticed that there's a lot of different fasts that you can take, and it seems to be even becoming mainstream. She takes this three-day fast. What exactly is the point of a fast? When I read it initially, I'm inclined to think of a toddler saying, I'm going to hold my breath until you give it to me, kind of thing. Is this what a fast is all about?
For me, it's this idea of discipline and focus. She was taking a moment to sort of step aside from the urgent feeling that they no doubt felt, you know, when in hearing about this edict and hearing...
Urgent is an understatement.
Exactly right. So she was taking a moment to step aside and to focus and devote her time to listening to what God wanted her to do next, and to really sort of allowing God to lead her in making the next decisions and making those next moves and figuring out what she was meant to do next in following, you know, God's plan in that part of her life.
So you say fasting is a moment of stepping aside and reevaluating. Mm-hmm. Great.
It's also a tremendous contrast to the decision making of her husband, starting in chapter one already. After 7 days of feasting and drinking and inebriation, he makes a very unwise decision, and she makes it much more soberly.
A complete opposite of fast, instead of a feast, before approaching this dramatic problem.
Valuing life and what she can do to affect life.
Mm-hmm. Well, this definitely would steer away from my idea of the toddler holding his breath here. This seems to be much more like there's something much more important. There's something that's so important that even the basics like eating pale in significance to this mission that I face now. And I need strength, divine strength, before I will attempt to tackle this over here.
I think it's interesting that she doesn't offer her life once. She offers her life twice. Mm. So she says, she makes the statement, if I perish, I perish. But then she comes again, and in the second banquet, she says, if I and my people, you know, and she offers to be one of them, one of the ones that doesn't survive the ordeal of the massacre.
This is really significant. I remember reading some stories of families there, you know, during the Second World War, where part of the family was to be deported to a concentration camp, and people that didn't qualify for extermination actually volunteering to join their families. And you got to think, well, this is an ultimate act of love, where you have the opportunity to escape, but you identify yourself with your family. This we have Esther here. Kind of throws me into the New Testament too, doesn't it? Where we have the ultimate identification of
solidarity with those who suffer and are vulnerable.
And Jesus becoming one of us. I mean, you know, he didn't have anything to do with anything. He could have stayed in his palace.
Yes.
Right.
If we get back to Esther, he could have stayed in his palace without touching him. Well, ladies, I am really enjoying our conversation over here. And there's one question that we want to have a look at in our next section. We realize that physical beauty and inner beauty are perhaps interlinked over here, but we want to explore this issue a little bit more. Exactly what can I do to learn to be happy in my own skin? We'll be answering that question and some other questions. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. speaking about the Book of Esther. If you've just joined us, we have a fantastic and beautiful panel here helping us out. And in this section, we want to talk about kind of hands-on questions. Not your kind of hands-on questions that we did, but here, the first one I really would like to ask you. You just quoted the verse a little bit earlier, you know, have you come into the kingdom for such a time as this?
Yes.
Esther's in the right place at the right time, and then we don't hear about her anymore, which is kind of sad. It would be nice to know what happened after that. But do each of us have a right time and a right place? Is this just a once-off occurrence?
I don't think so. I believe...
Which part don't you think so?
Oh, sorry. I believe that we come to a point and a purpose for a particular time. People often share stories about how if they were just 5 minutes faster, they might have been in an accident, mm-hmm. or they might have bumped into someone else, or they were at the right place at the right time to meet their husbands or something mm-hmm. of the sort. I believe that there is a right time. And we have to be open to God's opportunity to that and to listen to Him leading us to be there at the right time, because we miss an opportunity to share Him with others, or perhaps to be a witness, or to even allow Him to bless us.
Well, that's a great answer. I can hear that you've really internalized
that. I have story after story after story about God's providence at the right time.
And in this story, we see timing is everything.
It is.
And that's what's beautiful about Esther, is that not only do we get to see that right time at the right place, but we get to see all the things that led up to that. Mm-hmm. And it's all those things that allowed for that right time to be there. And so even if we don't feel like we're in that right time wherever we are, or we can't figure out what that right time is, through the example of Esther, we can know that there are many things that lead up to that. And so it's, you know, it's only time that can really tell us, you know, what will lead to another thing, which will lead to another thing, which will lead to that right time.
Now, that sounds beautiful, and you've got lots of stories. But now what happens mm-hmm. when, if I had just left home 5 minutes earlier, I wouldn't have been involved in that horrible car crash. Or if he had just done that, that tragedy wouldn't have occurred. Oh, the timing thing doesn't always seem to work.
This story illustrates how everybody has a measure of power, and that power is expressed in how we use words. We can use words to help people, to mm-hmm. harm people, to make rash decisions, to make mm-hmm. rash edicts. We can use words to create these wonderful, epic stories that record history, and that's what happened when the king could not sleep. He was read that mm-hmm. epic poetry of history, and that brought back to mind the act of Mordecai saving
right.
his life. So we see how words are flying around the Persian Empire, or I guess they were clay tablets at the time, like email on a Monday morning with horses galloping this direction, taking words this and words going this way. And we see how God is enacting in the midst of all of our words, all of our actions, all of our stories. Mm-hmm. He's enacting a cosmic story to his ultimate purposes, and his purposes don't know haste or delay. Mm-hmm. So we can use our power for good or for evil. That's mm-hmm. very clear. And we have an opportunity to use it for good and to have our words and our actions aligned with God's ultimate purposes. But God's ultimately in control, and it doesn't matter. This story says it doesn't matter even if people are trying to harm you. Like mm-hmm. Joseph said to his brothers, you meant
right.
to harm me. You meant to do it. And Haman meant to harm them. Mm-hmm. But even if finances are a challenge, or if we've lost somebody we love, or circumstances seem hopeless, mm-hmm. even when things are against us, God is working out his purposes for good. It's a story of redemption.
This is a wonderful story of redemption. This timing you've summarized for us so beautifully. But now, seeing that you answered the other question so well, I've got the big one for you. Here it is. How can I learn to be happy in my own skin? I don't know if, you know, I don't really consider myself an Esther beauty, although I'm really loved and I'm grateful for that. But not many of us feel really confident about our appearance. How do I learn to live with what I've got? How can I become an Esther even if I'm not that beautiful?
For me, as I'm growing older, I have a couple gray hairs in my... I am, through God's grace and His leading, becoming more comfortable with myself and becoming and able to trust myself so that when there are opportunities or words or opportunities to do good or I have a chance to speak kindly to someone in their behalf or to defend someone or to help advance a positive cause, then I feel comfortable in my skin regardless of how I may look at the moment or... It's beginning to trust yourself. And the other thing for me in my own life, my parents and my family have been very supportive. And I know not everyone has that opportunity and that blessing, but sometimes it's I'm grateful to my family for encouraging me.
Yes. Well, we all dream of being that princess, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
And yet we are. We are loved by the King of the universe. And as you said, that should be enough to make us comfortable in our skins. Well, we don't have much time left, and I was just beginning to really enjoy myself, but I don't want us to end without asking you just briefly, in a nutshell, what was your favorite part? We're going to begin with you, Melinda.
Okay. Well, it may not seem like something to point out as a favorite, but in chapter 4, when Esther first hears about what's happened, it says that she's deeply distressed. And even before she does anything, that's the first thing that happens. And for me, as someone who wants to go into medicine, that speaks to me. It's this idea of compassion and that she's feeling and her heart is with her people, despite being in, you know, this palace or wherever she is, apart from them, her heart is with them. And so I love that. And I love that that's what then leads her to pull in, you know, all the commands that she does.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Compassion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Heidi.
Redemption.
Redemption. You really put it in a nutshell.
I like that Mordecai redeems a girl. Mm. A girl that is not his sister, is not even that close. It's a cousin. Mm-hmm. I mean, her parents were aunt and uncle to him. And their names are mentioned in the book, but we wouldn't have known her if he hadn't redeemed her.
Right, right in the beginning. A little orphan girl who would think that she'd end up saving your skin as well. Great.
Character. She was noticed even among all these hundreds of women in the king's harem. And even when she was became queen, her character was known throughout the country for being kind and for being gracious and being courageous as well.
She had that factor, that something that was
that
there.
That big factor.
God helps the powerless. God helps the helpless. And today, He's still able to help with whatever it is that might seem insurmountable to us. He can still enact a cosmic story in our own lives redemptively. I like that word, redemptive.
God is still in control. Mm-hmm. Regardless of the intricacies, the plots, whatever it is, there is redemption. That is very hopeful.
Amen.
That's a beautiful ending for our story, I'd say. Ladies, thank you so much for joining me. Thank you, Melinda. Thank you, Heidi. We'll let you get out of that hot outfit that's maybe not so hot. Thank you, Franita.
Pleasure.
And a big thank you to you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Great having you. I really enjoyed the story, as you can hear. It's one of my favorites. But if you came in halfway through the program and you missed out on a part of it, please don't worry. You can go to hopetv.org/storyline. You can watch this episode with all of these lovely ladies, and you can also watch other episodes, and you could do it at your leisure. Now, if you want to share your reaction to the story, please go to our website or post on Facebook and Twitter. And remember that Storyline is also available in the iTunes stores as a podcast. You could download the entire episode and you can watch it on the go. Now, don't go anywhere. There's still more. There's more to this great story. So we'll be back just after a short break.
I know I'm looking for something. But what? Peace? Purpose? Meaning? I'm still not sure. But I know it's going to take faith.
Esther, an insignificant Jewish orphan in exile, rose to prominence through a series of very unpredictable events. And then Esther was confronted with a choice that had the potential, although she didn't know it, but the potential to change the course of history. Esther was face to face with the biggest risk of her life. It meant uncertainty, a very possible failure, and of course, there was a big fear factor. Yet, because of her willingness to trust in God, she was prepared to venture out on wings of faith. We all have times in which we seem to be flapping around without even getting off the ground. We wonder about our God-ordained niche in life. My work, my family, my relationships, my community. It may not be ideal, and yet it could be the place that God has placed me. Like Esther, to be at the right place, right here and right now, He could be calling me to be here for a time like this. The same power that was available to Esther as she fasted and prayed is available to us. We may not have an entire nation hanging in the balance, but we face these life-changing decisions. I'd like to invite you to put your storyline into God's hands.